26 of the world's richest people now own the same amount as the poorest half of humanity. That's one of those sort of pieces of pornography, economic pornography, that simply outrages. And it's the sort of thing that my next guest has been talking about, writing about, for decades. I'm told that he was on Late Night Live before I was, warning us of the long-term impacts of inequality. I don't think there's much evidence people were listening then, but there's mounting evidence that people are listening now, because, of course, as well as Frank's writings, we have Piketty and others banging the table, demanding to be heard. Frank Stilwell is Professor Emeritus in Political Economy in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Sydney, and the author of the book Political Economy of Inequality, published by Polity. And I'll hand lift it up because this is being videoed as we speak. Welcome back, Frank.
It's a pleasure.
Well, look, grim times. Where do we want to start here? Let's look at the proportion of income that people are generating from their existing wealth rather than their labour. That's increasing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's the obvious place to start, because people talk about income inequality, but underlying it, the inequality is in accumulated wealth. If you're talking about what accumulates over time, it's the product of those wealth inequalities. In other words, the physical assets that people own, the housing, the shares, the other financial assets. It's the concentration of that that really accumulates and drives the inequality of income.
So more people are earning their income from owning stuff than doing stuff.
Indeed. The International Monetary Fund official figures shows clearly that shifting shares between capital and labour, between people who derive income in the form of profits and rent and people who derive it from work and wages.
Frank, I think there's a possibility that you're not telling this ancient broadcaster the truth, because the ABS recently released data that showed that inequality is not increasing here.
Well, this wasn't the full story, Philip, and indeed some documents obtained under Freedom of Information revealed that drafts of that press release put together by the ABS had been modified in ways that, sanitised the document and made it seem as if inequality was stable when their own figures showed that it was rising.
Was the Productivity Commission involved in this?
No, but the Productivity Commission was involved separately in issuing a previous report that looked at wealth inequalities and came up with its own estimates that seemed quite out of line with all the other estimates, including those from the ABS.
I can't quite see the motivation for people to want to talk it down.
Well,
What does it achieve, even politically?
It is difficult. I mean, you might say ultimately the truth will out, but I'm worried that there's a capture of government agencies, not necessarily in an explicitly corrupt way, but agencies are increasingly refraining from telling the whole truth.
Okay, a recent report from the Grattan Institute indicates that the cost of housing in Australia is a major factor in increasing inequality.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting that a lot of these think tanks and research institutions are getting into this. I've worked a lot with the Evatt Foundation on work looking...
Sounds a bit pink to me.
Oh, it is light pink, yes. Representing the labour movement, but interested in the ratio of wages to other forms of incomes, and particularly in recent years focusing on inequality of wealth. And housing, of course, is one of those key elements of wealth. So I really welcome this Grattan report. It shows essentially that the disposable income of the rich after taking account of their housing costs, you know, rent or mortgage repayments, has increased markedly. That went up by 33% over 12 years to 2016. Whereas at the other extreme, people on lower incomes, their incomes after housing costs showed a trivial increase. In other words, housing costs are one of the main sources of the growing gap between the wealthy and the poor.
We're used now to the horror stories about inequality in highly developed capitalist societies, but it can also be observed, of course, in the Chinese economy, in Russia with its oligarchs. It escapes capitalism.
Sure. It's a worldwide phenomenon, but of course it's not equally unequal all around the countries of the world. Some of the big ones, the BRICS, are getting radically more unequal. China is increasing its overall prosperity, but it's really producing billionaires at a faster rate than it's lifting people out of poverty.
The important part, or one of the important parts of your fine tome, is what your research tells you about the consequences. So let's look at some of them. Higher crime, higher rates of mental disorders, reduced health and well-being, worse educational outcomes, more division, higher levels of corruption. Can you just sort of riffle through that?
Yeah, well, social science researchers have really picked up on this. A couple of British epidemiologists led the way with a book called The Spirit Level, which showed if you compare countries that are varying degrees of inequality, the ones that are the most equal, typically the Nordic states, but also Japan, have the lowest incidence of these various social problems. In other words, better health, both physical and mental, better rates of educational attainment, but lower rates of crime, violence, prison incarceration. In other words, the more equal the society, the more likely it has to be a happier, cohesive society.
I suddenly remember at the time when Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister were incredibly popular, that a study came out which showed that the higher up the public service you went, the healthier you were. And the argument was not only that you could afford to go to better Harley Street specialists, but you felt in control of your life. You felt emotionally secure.
Yeah. Well, the new book by Wilkinson and Pickett, these British epidemiologists, picks up on precisely those kinds of arguments, emphasising that it's questions of security and trust that are the key elements in creating a happier society or a happier stratum within an unequal society.
Frank, what about gender inequality?
Well, the gap is closing in various countries, but very, very slowly. Australia's mid-ranking in the international league table here. It's about 13% wage gap. In other words, the gender wage gap shows 13% difference between the average for full-time male incomes and full-time women workers.
One of the other areas of glaring inequality is the great increase in terms of salaries when you compare the CEO to the medium worker.
This is probably the most spectacular change of all that's been observed over the last quarter century. I remember research in Australia which showed the ratio, typically around 20 to 1, of CEOs to the average workers in their companies.
That's a fair whack anyway.
200. The companies function perfectly well with that level of inequality, it seems. But now it's more typically 200 to 1, not 20 to 1. And in the United States, it's getting on towards 400.
But that also, to use a term that I deployed earlier, is sort of pornographic, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I actually think that wealth and poverty are two sides of the same coin. We've always thought of wealth as being obscene, but now, poverty as being obscene, but now I think we're seeing that wealth is obscene, and that it's the relationship between the two that matters. Well, I mean, we've always known that poverty is associated with unhappiness, with various social disorders, criminal behaviour.
Well, it's
and so
associated
on,
with the need to take drugs, I would have thought.
It seems that.
Which circles
the case.
Back to our yes, last story yes. with Laura.
Exactly. Indeed, it is. But now I think we're seeing that it's inequality, not just poverty, but inequality. In other words, the gap between rich and poor that is the fundamental driver of a whole array of social problems.
One of the things your book asserts is that higher inequality results in lower productivity. That seems counterintuitive.
Higher inequality, lower productivity. Well, it comes out of research being undertaken at the International Monetary Fund, the OECD. And it's not really that surprising because within any household, any business, any sporting team, if there's a belief in fair shares in the fruits of the cooperative activity, you're more likely to get effective cooperation. And so if you push inequalities too wide, people do indeed get fractious, they get envious, they become less cooperative.
Okay, let's go back to the CEO salaries. You see it, those bloated salaries, as just a reward for making it to, in effect, to a very exclusive club.
Indeed. We're not talking about a meritocracy here. Indeed, there's no obvious correlation between the salaries and the performance of the companies being managed. We're talking about a self-rewarding oligarchy.
So there's no known correlation between that sort of reward and making money for the company.
Indeed.
I mean, that also is counterintuitive. One thought that this was, you know, the carrot and the stick of remuneration was there to drive vast profits.
Yes. That the problem is, I think, increasingly being recognised by shareholders. So we're not talking about the interests of an underclass being rising up and challenging capitalism here. We're talking about some of the key players in the system who are coming to realise that it doesn't function according to the basic economics textbooks.
Frank, as I said when we were introducing you, you've been banging on about this sort of topic now for decades. But there's one thing which is, I think, comparatively new in your book, and that is now a growing concern with environmental consequences.
Yes, I take the view that there's a very clear parallel here. And if we're to solve the climate change problem, that great shadow hanging over humankind, we need to link it to solving the inequality problem, or at least ameliorating the tendencies that have been causing growing inequality. Because if we don't actually feel we're all in the same boat, we're unlikely to engage in the cooperative activities, the adjustments, the transitions that are necessary to make a sustainable planet.
Well, clearly altruism just vanishes in this debate.
Yes.
As nations saying, well, you hear it from Australia again and again and again, you know, we only contribute X percent, we can't afford to, you know, to be this generous.
Yes, but ultimately it is a win-win situation. If we can cooperate on policies to save the planet and make it a fairer place, then we're talking about not just a transition, we're talking about a just transition.
Let's go back to the think tanks that you were talking about. You must see the renewed focus on inequality coming out of the think tanks as much as anywhere as vindication of the battles you've had.
Indeed, to some extent. I mean, the Evatt Foundation, the Fabian Society, the Grattan Institute, all good work being done. My task, I think, as ever, is to try to bridge between the generation of information and the development of a deep understanding, by which I mean not just more and more facts and figures, but an awareness of the underlying processes and what it would take to actually change direction.
That brings me back to my favourite aphorism, which I was quoting the other night on the program. Data isn't information, information isn't knowledge, and knowledge isn't wisdom.
Absolutely. I think this sums it all up. It's a complex world out there. It's buzzing with information, but we need to sort it out in ways that enable us to act intelligently and effectively.
I want to quote Gramsci to you. He talks about pessimism of the intellect versus optimism of the will. Talk about that.
Pessimism.
Because there is a great optimism in this book. Yeah. It's not all grim. Mm. It doesn't capitulate or surrender. It's really quite upbeat.
Yes. The phrase originally comes from Antonio Gramsci, and I think it really is the mindset that we need when dealing with wicked problems. Pessimism of the intellect requires that you face up to the challenges squarely. You can't just say, oh, she'll be right, mate. You need to analyse what are the challenges facing us, whether it's climate change, economic inequality or whatever. But optimism of the will is the stance that leads you to find solutions. In other words, to really grapple with the issues and
so you
and try
refuse
to
be
them.
Dispirited.
Absolutely.
You refuse to surrender or acquiesce.
Absolutely.
We've got to...
And being on your program, Philip, is a wonderful opportunity to explore precisely that connection. Between.
So you remain optimistic that we can turn this juggernaut around and move back to policies that will help create equality?
Yeah, it's a win-win challenge. I think ultimately the rich as well as the poor would benefit from reining in the system, from tempering capitalism, even transforming it to a system that is more equitable and sustainable for all.
Some of the oligarchs of the West seem to glimpse this, don't they? You see some of it with Buffett, you see some of it with Gates.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's a sufficient driver of change, but it is a portent of disquiet about the unsustainable character of the current arrangements.
It's an irony, isn't it, that in a sense the feeling of dispossession, the feeling of pessimism, the feeling of being unequal also, of course, drives such phenomena as the Brexit and the rise of Trump.
Oh, yes. I have a very good friend who's someone I wouldn't have expected to vote for Brexit in the UK, but he did, and he said publicly it was because of where he came from in the UK, one of the more depressed regions where people were feeling they were missing out on the fruits of economic progress. In other words, it was an expression of the inequality that the people in that location felt, even though this person you would normally expect to be on the sort of pro-European, pro-international integration end of the debate.
Let me ask you this. Where did you come from in that sense? What's your class background?
Oh, I was born in England with parents who were white-collar workers. My mother was an infant school teacher and my father a public servant working in the customs nexus.
And you finish up in a country which, when I was young, really believed it was possible to move towards a class-free society.
Well, when I first came to Australia, that was part of the attraction. I mean, I got a good job at the University of Sydney to come to. But my first impression was that this would be a great country to be in. And indeed, it has been. I stayed. I love it. But I've always felt that we're on that sort of knife edge between going down the US road to a more harsh and unequal society or going down the road towards the Scandinavian countries with a more cohesive and caring society.
So the Scandinavian countries are still performing well?
Yes, the influence of neoliberalism has bit there as it has in most parts of the world, but they're still the most egalitarian nations on the planet.
Finally, and we've only got moments left, tell me about the idea of the basic income.
Basic income is one way of lifting the floor in the distribution of income. In other words, dealing with poverty by giving everyone in society an income equivalent roughly to the official poverty line, around $20,000 a year, irrespective of whether they're working or not. And so obviously that payment going to wealthier people would largely come back to the government in the form of tax payments, but it would create a flaw which would eliminate poverty overnight and give people more freedom in the way in which they balance work and non-work activities.
You know, it's not entirely a loony left idea. I remember, of all people, Barry Goldwater arguing something like this during his presidential campaign.
Milton Friedman too, the right-wing economist, banged the drum for it. But going back further still, Bertrand Russell thought that this is something that in an ideal society one would move towards. In other words, as we got collectively wealthier, we could afford such a nice egalitarian policy. Maybe it's almost time.
I think it's almost time to hear more from Frank on inequality, and he will be speaking at the University of Sydney on Tuesday night, and we'll put details of that event on the website. Thanks, Frank. Frank Stillwell, Professor Emeritus in Political Economy in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Sydney, and author of The Political Economy of Inequality, published by Polity.